This is LNL on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia and The Pod. And here's a sting that is relevant to our next story by MC Lars.
Hey, Mr. Record Man, what's wrong with you? Still living off your catalogue from 1982. Hey, Mr. Record Man, your system can't compete. It's the new artist model, file transfer.
I've never heard that song before. It's called Download the Song. And it's there to signify the next segment. You know, our developed world is so heavily plugged into digital technologies that for many of you, you're only a power blackout away from boredom. What would you do without your electronic toys? Now, here in Australia, we've got a long record going back decades of consuming new technologies. We bought television in droves. We had the quickest take-up rate in the world for colour telly, for VCRs, ditto for DVDs, and I suspect we're pretty much at the head of the queue on MP3 players. Now, if you're one of the millions who use the internet, you'll know that the line into your home is also a line out, and privacy is being lost faster than your broadband connection, which they tell me in Australia isn't that fast anyway. Cory Doctorow is an advocate for consumers. I should point out that he's got a pseudonym, Cory, a.k.a. craphound.com. Isn't that a wonderful, wonderful name? He's an advocate for consumers in this complex world of digital rights, and he joins me now from London, and I welcome him to Late Night Live. And I've got to tell the listener, Cory, that the last time I did see you, when you were a star act at our Festival of Ideas in Brisbane, you were girded in a kilt, and you were heading for a dangerous part of Brisbane. Did you make it back okay?
Oh, we made it just fine. You know, I think that women have been keeping the secret of the unbifurcated garment from we blokes for far too long. And certainly once you hit the tropics, a kilt makes a lot of sense.
Well, I must say, you look very comely, although I thought the legs were a tad hairy, but that's just a personal view. Now, can you take us back to the history of the concept of digital rights? I suppose it begins with APRA, doesn't it? The Performing Rights Associations.
Well, it depends on what you mean by digital rights. From the perspective of the citizens, the idea of digital rights really goes back, I think, probably to the first time the police started to raid people's homes based on the stuff that they'd said on bulletin board systems and on the internet. And, you know, people started to make the connection, and they said, well, no one's raiding your house in a free country over what it is you said in the public square, but what you say on the internet might end up having a visit from the law. And we don't really know what metaphor applies most, right? If you say something naughty on the internet, is that like speaking in a public square, or is that like speaking, say, on a corporation's premises, say the corporation that operates the bulletin board system?
Or is it like something whispered in the bedroom between consenting adults?
Well, exactly. So, you know, the idea of digital rights, really, it sort of starts in the mid to late 1980s, and it really gets going at the end of the 1980s and the early 1990s with the formation of the first digital rights protection group, which is Electronic Frontier Foundation in the United States, whom I used to work for. And they were formed essentially to start defending people's rights on the internet, the same way that groups like the American Civil Liberties Union or Liberty here in the UK defend people's rights in the physical world.
And you've sort of placed yourself at the forefront of all this a bit, haven't you?
Well, certainly.
You're like that little figure in Tiananmen Square standing in front of the tank.
Well, no, except I'm more like the guy telling you that you should all be looking at the figure standing in front of the tank. The figures standing in front of the tank are often computer programmers or computer users who find themselves on the wrong side of antiquated laws. Or you know, it's worse than an antiquated law, is a modern law written specifically to kind of keep the internet from happening. And so, you know, that we've got a couple of internet treaties that have come out of the United Nations World Intellectual Property Organization that basically say that governments should pass laws that punish people who treat the internet like a medium that was designed to copy things and communicate freely. And say, well, if you go ahead and use this thing for what it was intended, we'll bust you. So, you know, those are the people in front of the tanks. Teenagers like Jan Johansson, who was a kid in Norway, who figured out how to watch DVDs on his PC and spent 5 years in court defending his right to have written that software.
Hmm. When you were in Brisbane being carried shoulder high through cheering crowds, you were warning of a dark age for technology. We're getting into all sorts of mixed metaphors here, aren't we? Are you talking about a dark age for the consumer or for the hapless, vulnerable manufacturer?
Well, I think that, you know, the idea of the Enlightenment, the idea of the thing that brought an end to the dark age was really the idea that information should be shared, that knowledge should be shared, that progress occurs when we all share knowledge. And no matter what regime we've had since then, that's been a fundamental piece of it. Even systems like the patent system are all about sharing knowledge, right? We'll give you a 20-year exclusive right to your invention if you'll tell everyone how it works, so that when your exclusive right expires, we can stand on the shoulders of you, our giant, and see farther. And right now we're entering a regime where telling people how stuff works, we're experimenting on the tools that we use and own, is becoming unlawful. Increasingly, the technology that we use has access control measures that are supposed to keep us from making unlawful or unauthorized copies of copyrighted work.
Give us some instances.
Well, the thing that most Australians are probably most intimately familiar with is a DVD player that that has region coding on it and that restricts you from watching one DVD or another depending on where it was made. Now, there's no copyright law that says that the person who makes a DVD gets to tell you what country you're allowed to watch in. This is more like a para-copyright. It's a technological restriction that's illegal to circumvent. So it's not that the law says you can or can't do that. It's that if there's a fence around some right that you want to exercise, breaking the fence is illegal. It doesn't matter whether or not you have the right to exercise that technological measure.
It's interesting you raise that, because for many years there was a great shit fight in Australian publishing because we weren't allowed to get books until they'd gone through a sequence of distribution, you know, after the US and the UK. And that was one. That was one in Australia. But now it's happening, or still happening, with DVDs, yeah?
Well, certainly. And even under that regime, if you lawfully acquired the book while you were on holidays, for example, if you went off to here, you know, to London where I live and bought a Penguin paperback at a Waterstones and then brought it home again, the customs man wouldn't make you bin it at the border because the Penguin didn't have the right to distribute that book in the United Kingdom. Once you'd lawfully acquired your property, the book, it was yours. The interesting thing about this DVD stuff isn't whether or not you're watching a movie or not watching a movie. That's just the surface. The interesting thing about it is that when you go out and you buy a DVD player today, you're buying a device that's designed to control you. Mm. You're buying a device that when you press play, instead of saying, does my owner want me to play this disc, it says, does some cartel of film studios thousands of miles away in California want me to play this disc? Well, you know, imagine if your hammer or your blender or your dishwasher didn't listen to you, but listen to someone whose business model you might be disrupting somewhere thousands of miles away, and indiscriminately did that. So, you know, you have things like Sony distributing disc CDs that are intended not to be copied, and in order to ensure that those discs aren't copied, they essentially installed a virus on your computer that disabled parts of your operating system so that you couldn't copy the disc. And they distributed 100 titles this way, several million discs, and they infected 500,000 computer networks, including many U.S. military and government networks, and faced legal action as a result of it. But it's an amazing circumstance for a company like Sony to say, we are going to design a technology that we hope to sell to the public whose most engineered feature is that if you ask it to do something, it will tell you no, right? We're going to design a product that we're essentially on the package, it'll say now with fewer features.
Tell me about the Electronic Frontier Foundation and your role as an advocate. How do you fight City Hall on this?
Well, sure. So EFF is a civil liberties group. I'm no longer an employee. I quit my day job back in January to write novels full time, but EFF continues, and I'm a fellow of the organization. And EFF is a privately funded, donor-supported civil liberties group that takes money from average individuals and uses it to fight against the worst excesses of technology law. So one thing that EFF is doing right now is suing AT&T, the giant American telecoms company, over its complicity with the National Security Agency in wiretapping millions of Americans on behalf of the National Security Agency. And the penalties that are available in the event that EFF wins are $100 per customer per day. So really, it's enough money to basically put AT&T out of business should EFF win.
Do you find solace with the U.S. Constitution or the Bill of Rights? Is there finally the Supreme Court? Are they forced to support you?
Well, that's it. That's just it, is that where you have recourse to constitutional principles, you can hold companies and indeed governments to account on their failure to uphold the principles that they're meant to be coherent with. And so previously EFF fought successfully for the right of software authors to publish their code on the grounds that code was one of the forms of expressive speech that the Constitution protects. So if the law says you can't repress speech, then you can't repress code. And what they had done was they said, here's a mathematician, he's written a textbook, he's published it in book form. It contains code that's illegal, right? That code was code to help people scramble their messages so well that neither the mafia nor the police could read them. That those are the scrambling systems that you currently get when you buy a book or use your banking on the Internet. Those scrambling systems were unlawful to use in America. And EFF fought successfully for the First Amendment right, the free speech right, to publish that code.
Corey, I thought that you dot communists were so dead clever that no matter what the giant corporations threw at you, you could, you know, burrow around it or jump over it and, you know, subvert it. Isn't that the case?
Well, there is that idea that, you know, as one of EFF's founders once said, the Internet treats censorship as damage and routes around it. And the problem is that falls down where you are not one of the technological elite, right? Being for example, if you're a Chinese dissident and you want to circumvent the Great Firewall of China, if you have technological skills, it's not a hard thing to do. If you lack those technological skills, it might as well be impossible. And the question isn't, can some very, very bright young hacker make this work, even if the government doesn't want him to or her to? The question is, can the people who need these liberties the most gain access to them, right? So if you live in a country or if you work in an office or if you go to a school where your communications are censored by some indiscriminate censoring firewall, can you get around them? Well, maybe, but there's not necessarily any confluence of people who want free speech and people who know about computers. Right? The one is not a prerequisite for the other, nor should it be.
My guest is the tartaned, sporrand technology activist and a blogger, Cory Doctorow, and this is ABC Radio National's Late Night Live, also on Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and each week downloaded onto over 50,000 MP3 players as well. Now, let's go to music for a minute, Corey. What are the effects on the marketplace and on musos when so much music is downloaded?
Well, it's pretty disruptive for sure. You don't have to look very far to see that. It's probably at least as disruptive as it was when we invented radio. You know, and we went from a world where all the people who were making a living performing music were performing it in music halls. And those people had to adapt to performing music on the radio. And if the thing that made them a success in the music hall was that they did a great song and dance and not that they were brilliant at playing their instruments, they probably didn't have a career when it came to radio. A lot of those people went into business. And indeed, many of the vaudeville artists back in those days tried to sue Marconi for creating radio companies that they felt were putting them out of business. And today we're facing a very similar kind of thing where there are some musicians who are clearly making great bank off of the Internet, musicians who are adopting copy-friendly business models where they rely on people turning up at their shows or buying their merchandise or what have you as a way of succeeding in the new technological marketplace. And there are lots who can't do that. There are people who are great studio musicians but stink on stage, or people who don't want to do it or whatever. And those people are ending up in the same place that the vaudeville players did.
Yeah.
And I think the question we need to ask whenever a new technology comes along that enables new forms of creativity isn't, will this put some people out of work? Because, you know, that's kind of what happens with technology. You know, the blacksmiths get put out of work by the railroads and the horseless carriages. The question, the important question is, does this increase the ability of an average individual to participate in culture?
But, Corey, you don't just talk the talk, you walk the walk, don't you? Because I remember you explaining that your novels are published, yes, by a publisher, but they're simultaneously released on the net under Creative Commons licenses that encourage their use and sharing.
Quite correct. And that's been a gigantic success for me. My first novel now has been downloaded something like 700,000 times from my website and other
wow.
people's websites. And it's now in its sixth printing, and it's been published in four or five languages, and it continues to sell briskly, and it won awards and so on.
I shall do the rest of the interview on my knees. I am so awestruck by that.
Well, you know, for me as an author writing science fiction, which is hardly, you know, a mainstream pursuit, it's we're not talking about, you know, the Rolling Stones or Britney Spears. We're talking about something that it's only the odd anorak who enjoys reading a science fiction novel every now and again. My big problem isn't piracy. It's obscurity, right? And the more people there are who have the ability to take my book and do what people have done with books since time immemorial, which is you take this book and you shove it into a friend's hands and you say, by God, you've got to read this. It changed my life. The ability for people to do that with friends that they only know over the Internet by giving them these electronic texts has been a tremendous boon to me because it helps my fans do what fans have always done, evangelize the authors whose works they love.
Mate, Ray Bradbury's entire book sales in his career wouldn't equal that amount of downloading, would it?
Well, keep in mind, none of those people paid, right, to download the book. But anyone who then wanted to get a hard copy had to go to the shop and buy it.
Right.
So, you know, it's basically, I tend to think of downloading a book as like picking it up off the shelf at a bookshop and kind of giving it a fondle and a sniff and deciding whether or not you want to pick it up. And people who do retail research say that, you know, for a lot of potential customers, you get five or six or even seven contacts with a product before you decide to buy it.
Use your example, they can also have a pretty good future.
Well, there are some musicians, certainly. If you look at, bands that are MySpace bands that are hanging out on the website MySpace, you know, some of those bands are selling 500,000 or 1 million CDs just off the back of people who encounter their music as free downloads on the Internet. The band Bare Naked Ladies, very famous Canadian band from my hometown of Toronto, they've just started releasing their tracks as free downloads as well.
Well, Corey, does copyright have a future then, or is it just an idea that's run out of time?
Well, no, of course copyright has a future, but it's got a different future than its past. You know, copyright changes when technology changes, because the thing that copyright impacts is technological, right? Copying is a technological activity. So it's like when the radio was invented, we needed a copyright law that made radio possible. No one was going to say to a DJ, your $400 an hour solicitor has to call my $400 an hour solicitor and negotiate whether or not your needle drop is going to cost 10 or 15 cents before you can play a song on the radio. Instead, we got new copyright regimes, we got blanket licensing systems, we got systems that allowed for underlying compositions and the performances to be lawfully retransmitted over the air. We had similar changes in copyright law with the VCR and so on. Australia is currently undergoing great upheaval in its copyright system to try and figure out whether or not the iPod is or isn't legal, whether your MP3
yeah.
players are or aren't legal. And you know, those are natural. That's part of the natural order of copyright. You know, if you sit down to write a law about how people can and can't use technology, and then a new technology is invented, to assume that the old law will continue to work is silly. It's like saying, you know, well, you know, now that we've got rocket ships, do stop signs have a future? Because obviously a rocket ship isn't going to come to a stop at a stop sign. You know, how will we manage traffic among rocket ships? Well, we won't do it with stop signs. But traffic laws have a future.
You only hear discussions, learned discussions about how you're going to organize traffic lights for rockets on this program. I'm very proud that we're breaking this ground. Now, the producers that work on this program, Corey, not only working in the 21st century, most of them were born in it. And they pass on notes to me. And I've just got a note from one of them who's, I think, 5 years old, but pretty bright. And that is that the US Congress has just passed a law, indeed yesterday, making people pay for traffic on the net. What do you reckon?
Not quite, actually. One branch of the U.S. government has passed a law that says that phone companies are allowed to essentially charge people coming and going for Internet traffic. So they can go to – not only can they charge you for your DSL connection and charge Google for its high-speed connection to its data center, they can then charge Google again for its ability to connect to you, right, which is – completely grotesque. I mean, a phone company is nothing but a thin veneer of greed wrapped around a regulatory monopoly. And it's unsurprising to see that they want to do this dumb, terrible thing. And I think that anyone who has any sense about this thinks that this would be a very bad idea for the internet and for innovation and for free speech and for free expression. That said, we have to figure out how we can shame and tame the phone companies, because asking, like in the U.S. it's the Federal Communications Commission, in the U.K. it's Ofcom, I'm not sure what it would be in Australia, asking these regulatory bodies to be in charge of the phone companies and keep them from doing harm is silly, because these are agencies that are so captured by the phone companies today that if they're our defense, we might as well give up now. So I think that there's a big open question about how we can make this happen. I don't think that law is going to pass the Senate, because I think it's pretty easy to get a million Americans to write to their senators and say, if you let the phone companies break the internet in this way, we're going to fire you in the upcoming 2006 midterm election.
Well, if they write is hardly relevant, but they can certainly email them. Look, Cory Doctorow, blogger, writer, technology activist, the bloke standing over there with the fluorescent sporran.
Thank you.
On our next, isn't it funny the way we always say the same things at the beginnings and ends of programs? It's not our next, it's your next. On your next, the new security alliance between Australia and Indonesia, whoopee-doo. And I'll be talking to the writers and directors of a film that attempts to find out what happened to a 13-year-old Japanese girl abducted by the North Koreans 30 years ago. Yes, we've looked at the story in the past, but it seemed like a second-rate Cold War spy story. But it's all terribly and rather sadly real. Stick around for the news. That's, we always say that as well, don't we? And we'll see you later. So I'm not going to say that tonight.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.